Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening Requiem for the American Dream, Miles Ahead, The Dark Horse, 45 Years, and more. At the E-Bar on April 28th, see Ivory Hours, The Medicine Hat, and Common Deer. On April 29th, see The Human Rights, The Foundation Steppas, and DJ Nikki Dredd. And on April 30th, it's the Guelph Pride Variety Show. The Bookshelf is an independently owned cultural hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph, Ontario. For more information about the Bookshelf's hours, listings, blogs, directions, accessibility, and to order books from their online store from anywhere in the world, please visit the newly designed bookshelf.ca.
Once young boy, he built a fort, so call around his pals and come to play. If there ain't enough room,
for your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure. Pizza Trocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-1 special. Pizza Trocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit Trocadero.ca.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Hello and welcome to episode 251 of Creative Control. On this program, a conversation with Matthias Kamm and Ariel Charette of The Burning Hell, who are one of the best and smartest pop rock folk bands in the whole wide world. They currently consist of people from Peterborough, Ontario, St. John's, Newfoundland, and Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. Those are just some of the places where Matthias and Ariel have lived and picked up people along the way, but they are a solid band. Their latest witty, outspoken, and reflective record is called Public Library. It's out now via a wonderful Canadian label called Headless Owl, and it's prompted the band to tour all over the place in the next little while. On a very recent Sunday, I caught up with Matthias and Ariel in Toronto to discuss various things, and that's what you're going to hear on this episode. It's us in conversation, talking about them, talking about the world, talking about nostalgia, and all sorts of other things as well. And you're going to hear a new song from Public Library. So that's the show. This is myself and The Burning Hell.
Like a canary without a coal mine, I am dying just for something to do.
agenda's wide open. I've got Enya in my headphones. Carve the words to Orinoco flow in my headstone. I'd sail away, sail away, sail away with the fishes. Describe the feeling, but I can't find the words. I'm sure there's a term in German, maybe one or two in Spanish, but I wanna feel that feeling. I wanna find somebody.
Right now in Toronto,
we are at Snakes and Lattes on College and Bathurst.
Snakes and Lattes, that's a clever title, yeah, for a place. What would you suggest to people listening is the point of Snakes and Lattes?
It's a games cafe.
A games cafe. Right.
Ariel can explain it.
Board games, specifically.
Board games. Yeah. Are these kinds of things popping up more and more? And you guys are world travelers. Hello. Oh, look at that. There's my cappuccino. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you.
And I didn't even know you drank coffee. I didn't think you drank
coffee. I know. That's actually one of the first things I remember about us meeting. Thank you very much. This is great. Oh, and I got water? Yeah. We got some. We were just actually, I don't know if you want to participate or.
I can't because I'm under the union.
You're in the union? What is it? Oh, I didn't know that.
ACTRA. Oh, ACTRA.
Yeah, oh, okay, okay. Fine. That's fine. I didn't even think of that. We'd have to pay that guy just to, for his insight. He's an actor. Of course he's an actor. Of course.
Toronto.
Everyone's an actor. You and I, Matthias, did a tour together across Canada. I was thinking about this on the way here. I've seen parts of the world that I would never have seen if it weren't for my meeting you and knowing you. Do you know this?
Is that true?
I think it is. I mean, because you and Ariel and some other people started the Lanya Vanya Festival in St. John's, Newfoundland.
Right.
That's the first time I ever got, and you urged me to come and MC and I don't know what else, cover it, I guess, for media purposes. I got to see St. John's and now I just go every year.
You go every year. It's tradition.
They've been very, very, yeah, they've been nice to keep inviting me. And then you and I and Wax Mannequin did this cross-country tour, and I got to see... I mean, I've been to most of the places we went to. We went to BC and back?
Yeah, I went to BC and back, but I bet you'd never been to Bruno, Saskatchewan before.
No, and I hadn't been to... Like, we did, of the 27 dates, 13 of them seemed to be in British Columbia.
British Columbia? I had never been there before.
Oh, you hadn't either?
No, gosh, no.
And then all the islands, like, we seemed to be on boats and all sorts of stuff, and then we... I believe we were all in Dawson City for Dawson City Music Festival in the Yukon.
2010?
Yeah, 2010. And I mean, this wasn't necessarily your doing, but you invited me on stage to play with the Burning Hell.
Yeah.
And it seems weird that we were always in these...
And would you have come to Snakes and Lattes this morning if it wasn't for Ariel and I
absolutely
saying this is
not.
Where we should meet?
So absolutely not.
Here we are.
But as I recall, and you can correct me if I'm wrong... We obviously knew each other pretty well before the tour with Chris, with Wax Mannequin, but at the same time, we're kind of getting to know each other.
Yeah.
We hadn't spent time on the road or anything like that. And the very first practices we had were in Guelph.
Yeah.
And I think we were on our way to the very first one or something. And my recollection is you said to me, I'm going to go get a coffee. Do you want one? And I said, no, I don't drink coffee.
Yeah.
And then my understanding is you sent a panic-stricken text message to our mutual friend, Jenny Mitchell, to say, what the hell? I'm going on tour with a guy and he doesn't drink coffee. I don't understand.
Did Jenny tell you that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that part might have not happened.
Jenny doesn't exaggerate. Jenny's view of the world is always clear.
Yeah, crystal clear.
My understanding is that not you? Were you not surprised at the time that I didn't?
I was surprised. I mean, you seem like the sort of person that drinks coffee.
What does that mean? Because I'm high strung and anxiety ridden, have neuroses?
Yeah.
Now I'm feeling paranoid about that.
It seems like coffee would go naturally with you.
With you know, what? My work? My profession?
Where you work, your profession? Yeah, the way you...
I had a thing. I had a thing for a long time, and it's come up on the show before, where I refuse to have any crutches. Any conventional crutches.
Yeah. Like, it's like a straight edge thing.
I guess so. Yeah. It stems from that. Yeah. Just like, and I mean, as we all know, coffee is an acquired taste.
Yeah. And but you've acquired it now. I'm looking at a cappuccino that you ordered.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah. So what happened was my wife, I impregnated my wife and then she couldn't have coffee as much. She had to have like limited coffee and she was just didn't have the energy to make. You're not supposed to have coffee, basically.
Yeah.
I think, particularly when you're trying to make.
You have to be, she was straight edge at that point.
At that point, she had to sort of drop off on the coffee. But then when we had our son, I was like, I don't know how to make, I want to help you. I want to make you coffee. How do you do it? She taught me how to do it. And then I kind of got addicted to the ritual of doing it. Stovetop coffee maker with the time we had a little pot where I would froth milk.
Yeah.
And it was just a nice routine.
Yeah.
I kind of developed the routine. And then I went to Chicago.
I know. I did see that, but I thought you were drinking that Steve Albini coffee as just like a one-off. Like that was just a one-off. Yeah.
Okay. Steve Albini made me this Kopi Luwak coffee, and my friend Colin Medley and I kind of made a little short film about him preparing this super fancy coffee, and then I drank it on in the thing we made. It wasn't very special. It was just like a short little internet video. And then again, the ritual of making coffee and frothing the milk and making it all, it's kind of cool. Like it's just kind of a neat invention that I'd never knew much about. So then I got addicted to that process almost. And then I started drinking it. And now if I don't drink it every day, I get a horrible headache.
Oh yeah.
So I'm addicted to coffee.
Yeah.
And I don't know whose fault it is anymore.
That's probably Steve Albini's.
I guess it's probably Steve Albini's fault. Yeah. But in any case,
it's not Michelle's fault.
No, it's my fault for impregnating her. That's just, I can't emphasize that enough. Twice. Anyway, yeah. So that's how we basically. That was one of your first impressions of me.
Yeah.
Was that I was a guy who never drank.
This feels coffee. More normal. Like looking at you here with a cappuccino in front of you. That seems normal now.
Yeah. So and we're at a place called Snakes and Lattes. Ariel, you've been in Toronto for school the last year or so.
Yeah, that's right. Since September.
And you live kind of around the corner?
Just around the corner.
So how often do you frequent this place?
This is my first time, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. I just thought it would be quiet.
Yeah, it seems relatively... doesn't seem like games are very popular in Toronto at the moment.
Maybe not at 11:30 in the morning, anyway.
It's kind of interesting that we came to a place that I think is this melding of adult tastes and kids' tastes, because you guys, in your writing of late... This is going to be an amazing segue, guys.
Uh-oh.
Well, I do think in your writing of late, we've talked about this, I think, also off the record, that there's... No, no, I'm going to do it. Thank you. You're going to help me unwrap my muffin?
Okay, go ahead. You're doing it with one hand.
I know. Well, I got to hold
it. Kind of awkward.
Okay, go ahead. Do it. You can.
I just thought it could be...
Yeah, no, it's very nice of you. No, I don't think this is worth miking. Okay. Actually, it is worth miking, yeah. I got a banana chocolate chip muffin with... Oh, you know what else? Okay. I want to finish my point here. Which is that I think that you of late have been very reflective upon formative aspects of your teenage years and your childhood, and
yeah,
and it's coming up more and more in your writing and kind of revisiting those times as an adult, but also those how I think those sentiments are still relevant to you today. Is that accurate?
More or less, yeah.
Yeah,
that's is that pretty bang on. I'd say hit the nail on the head.
And so why we're both this, Matthias and I, we discovered on our trip, Ariel, that Matthias and Chris of Wax Mannequin and myself all exactly the same age, more or less the same upbringings. We just discovered it was weird, right? That was kind of weird.
It was surprising. Yeah,
yeah, we were all exactly around 38 or so. Or at the time we were whatever.
We were like 20.
Yeah, exactly. That was 6 years ago. So yeah. So we were all around the same age, and so we're all kind of going through the same things in some ways. I mean, we all do our different things, but we came of age at the same time and kind of relate to the world in sort of similar ways. So I can relate to what you're going through, but can you both talk about why you might be feeling reflective in this time? Is there something about this time that feels dissatisfying or scary or something?
Oh, I think there's something about every time that feels dissatisfying and scary. But this time in particular is speaking first, not about myself, but I think about the times in general and like thinking about snakes and lattes and games cafes and all that kind of stuff. It seems like there is a turn now towards childhood again in popular culture in a way. With think about like the you know endless revisions of every superhero franchise.
Oh
and,
yeah,
you know, and games cafes popping up in places, and you know comic books having a resurgence and or another moment or whatever. And it seems like I don't know if it's I don't think it's the millennials. I think it's like actually my generation that is more and more nostalgic for youth, which is understandable because of death. So,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Like when you reach
a certain age,
we're and kind of at middle age.
We are, yeah.
It's people. I think used to say 50 was middle age, and you know we are living longer, but I feel middle aged.
Yeah, it's 38 is middle aged.
Yeah, 40, yeah. 40-ish. You're kind of like
38. I would say is yeah. That's like that's the hill. That's the top of the
but
hill.
But Ariel, you're a little younger.
Ariel's young.
You're younger than us.
Yeah, I'm 31.
Oh my God.
So I'm quite youthful.
First of all,
I believe.
Congratulations, Matthias. Second of all, no, that's horrible. 31. So you are fresh-faced on some level, but not really. You're 31.
Yeah.
That's also, you're an adult.
I'm aging.
can you relate to what Matthias is talking about, or what's your take on that?
I don't, about the return to childhood, I'm not sure, because I kind of feel like that has been an ever-present kind of thing that people get into, possibly all around the same age, but I don't think it's unique to this generation. I would argue, I mean, I can't think of any particular examples, but this is not the first time that comic book franchises have, like, come around, you know, that's been happening for
that's true.
Years and years, and people revisiting, yeah, the stories of their childhoods. I mean, all of the movies in the 80s were about people being kids in the 50s, so they're obviously people
of
a certain age. Yeah, maybe not all of them.
Certainly Back to the Future, which kind of has loomed large in a lot of your work lately.
Well, and a lot of the things that Matthias references, yeah, Stand By Me or...
oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, the one with the vampire boys or whatever.
The Lost Boys.
That one. Yeah,
the vampire boys.
Yeah. I mean, I am younger.
yeah, sure. Here's a perspective on it. And I want your perspectives on this idea. Beyond TV shows and other aspects of pop culture, we are seeing a lot of reboots. Mm-hmm. We are seeing a lot of people remaking things from the past as a contemporary thing. We're also living in an age where records are reissued constantly. Mm-hmm. And that's weird. Like, everything is like, if you've got a 20th anniversary or 30th anniversary of something, mm-hmm. Fair game now to put out a new version of the thing. It is a weird time for ideas, maybe. It feels like people might be... the fact that people are... You know, these things come up because there's a hunger for them. It's not just out of some celebration of art. It's, oh, there's probably an audience that's going to buy this.
Right.
What do you think that says about people's satisfaction with what's going on these days? Because I do think that we... As much as we try to celebrate emerging artists, it's sort of weird how fixated we are on things that came out before and maybe why they might still be relevant today.
I wonder if it is, to go back to a part of your question a minute ago, if it really is that there's a hunger for that, or whether, you know, people aren't paying attention to whatever new things are happening in music or art or film or whatever, or whether it actually is just the film industry and the music industry and so on saying, you know what would be easier than investing in new artists? It would be so much easier to just remake this old stuff. And then it's a case of the market sort of, or the industry creating the market rather than the other way around.
Huh. So they're creating, and the platform thing is another thing that they're grappling with and we are dealing with too, right?
Yeah.
Because they're trying to, everything that we loved from our formative periods in life has to be remade for digital platforms, or in weirdly in your case, you guys very kindly just handed me two slabs of vinyl.
Yeah.
I think those of us who listen to music regularly know that this vinyl resurgence is, I don't know if it's, I think there's obviously an upsurge in vinyl purchasing. Some people argue that it's always been there. And it's true. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. it's a very long-standing format. It never really went anywhere. But clearly something's going on. You are now, as a band, because people are not buying CDs, you're forced to, I assume it's more money to invest in.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
In making more of these things.
Yeah.
And so it's a weird pressure that's almost based on platform. It's a weird mix of nostalgia and platform development that I'm confused about. And I mean, your perspective, you guys just made a brilliant video for one of the songs on the record, which is called Fuck the Government, I Love You. Beautiful video.
Thank you.
Where do videos live now? You just post it yourself.
That's a strange thing, right? I mean, yeah. We are willingly, actively, indie bands, major bands, whatever, we're actively creating content for YouTube, which is the site that pays the absolute least per play to artists.
Right.
So, but we're willingly going there because apparently we still need videos, even though that's where videos live now.
And have you found that the videos, it's a promotional, videos were also always a promotional thing.
Yeah.
But there used to be real, a tangible result.
Yes.
Have you seen, I mean, you're putting,
it's impossible to measure.
I mean, did people get paid to have their videos on MTV? It wasn't, I don't think
no,
so.
But I think it was probably impossible to measure back then too. But it's certainly, I can't figure out how to correlate YouTube clicks or whatever YouTube plays to ticket sales at a show, for example.
Oh yeah. It's hard to draw a direct line from one to the other. I mean, I think we have, you know, people reference our videos and stuff. So I assume that they're looking at them and maybe that's how they discovered us.
And you've got the metrics that you can see in real time if someone's viewing or not in
yeah.
real time.
Like yeah.
Your clicks
yeah.
go up and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think we're very good at Google Analytics. So I don't know how exactly things are translating into engagement with our tour dates or anything.
But it's also, I mean, I think the positive side of the video resurgence or this, you know, new need for video on platforms like YouTube is that bands like us that have no budget can have a really good time making them, you know, and turn the experience of making a video into an end in and of itself.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's super fun.
It's like, in some ways, maybe more fun than making a record.
In some ways, yeah. Yeah.
It's not as, it just seems ridiculous
it
and
is.
Silly.
It's,
and
it's fun. You can do anything you want. And we don't have the pressure of, you know, a $50,000 budget or $100 million budget or whatever to say like, oh, we've got to make this amazing video.
Or even a $50 budget.
Or a $100 budget, yeah.
You don't have very big budgets.
No. But it's great. It takes the pressure off so we can really do whatever we want.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're living in an unregulated world as well as an independent artist. I mean, you're on a couple of different labels, right?
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily need to answer to them.
No.
You're your own boss.
I mean, we probably, yeah, we kind of do have to answer to them, I guess.
They're pretty independent.
They like our answers.
They let us.
Yeah, sure.
They like, yeah.
I had a fellow on the show recently. His name is Joe Casey. He's the singer and songwriter in a band called Proto Martyr from Detroit. And we ended up in this tangent about how he has discovered that their true measure of success as a band is how many T-shirts they sell.
So true.
Like record sales are not even as exciting anymore, but merchandise and T-shirt sales really tell you how your night has done.
On the last tour that we did, I took to saying on a lot of nights, you know, when I would have to talk at some point, I have to mention the fact that we had stuff for sale.
Yeah.
I would usually say, we just put out a brand new T-shirt and it's over at the merch table. And it started as a joke. And then I realized that it's the real thing. I mean, yeah. The albums are bought as an afterthought in some ways. People are excited about the T-shirt.
What does that say about the thing you do? Your thing is not, you didn't get into this to be clothing manufacturers and retailers. You got into this to make music. How do you feel when your T-shirts are outselling your records?
Well, I think obviously people are accessing the records in different ways, and so they're streaming them. And so I think it becomes more important for people to show fandom in different ways. Like people don't buy records, but but more and more probably they buy t-shirts, you know, because it I don't know, I just think it's more like people are real fans now in some ways, I think. Mm. Like at least in smaller and smaller little constellations of fans per band, you know, maybe you don't get as many fans as you used to and you don't sell as many records, but the people who are your fans, they want a t-shirt because they have I don't know, they're still trying to show some love of the music, and but obviously if you can get it for free, you know, you're not going to buy the cow.
Well, you know what else though, I've overheard people say they've bought a t-shirt out of guilt.
Right.
Because
that's depressing.
They've downloaded the record for free,
right?
Yeah.
Or heard the record for free on your Bandcamp, and right, they've streamed it, and they're like, you know, I hear this all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're walking out of a venue, you hear people literally saying, I bought a t-shirt, you know, just because I wanted a t-shirt, but I just did it because I got the record for free. What do you think of that? That's a weird mentality.
Yeah.
The music is so secondary. It's so vital to the experience, but people are trying to show their
love. People wouldn't be there if we were just, you know, only selling t-shirts.
They might be. My point is they might be at this point.
Yeah, we do have good t-shirts. We have really good t-shirts.
You do. You could sell at Lee's Palace with a bazaar at this point of just burning hell stuff. Maybe, you know what I mean? Like, that's a weird time.
It is a weird time, for sure. For sure. Yeah, it makes you question, you know, why record at all, you know, at a certain point. It's like, why shouldn't we just play live music? And if people want to hear the new songs, they could just come to a show.
That's actually not a bad idea. Maybe we should think about that.
I mean, think of the budgets and the money you're spending and the resources you're spending. I'm sorry, I don't want this to happen, by the way.
You're like really talking us out of ever making another album.
No,
but when Public Library was our last record.
No, don't do that. Yeah. Don't say that. My point is that I do think that there has been this, if you actually think about it, it's really weird.
It is really
the
weird.
The record sales declined.
Yeah.
And so artists were saying, we're going to devote more energy to touring because that's how we really make our money, particularly if we're on a label, because they have to we have to recoup everything, and that takes forever. The real money that comes to us is from touring. Then touring shifted into this thing where so many bands are like, we're going to play our album live.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, but no one likes your album. They're not buying them anymore. But people are like, oh, my God, I get to see Bruce Springsteen play The River.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, why don't you just buy the record? I mean, now you're going to an experience.
Just buy the record, but look at a picture of Bruce Springsteen at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I just mean now you're going to a situation where people felt so free as consumers to be like, I can get a single or I can get a song anywhere now. I can watch it on YouTube. I don't have to buy the record.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It translated into people going on tour and just playing their records, which makes for a very, for me anyway, a stilted experience of like, I know everything that's about to happen.
Yeah.
Whereas the live show for me is supposed to be a shock and a surprise. So I don't know. I'm just saying these things to you, not because I think you have answers, but you guys are out on the road. You are part of this culture. You are producers of stuff. You create things. Yeah. So I just wonder, I'm not trying to depress you at this.
I'm not depressed. No,
empty,
no, I'm not depressed by
completely empty games bar.
Cafe.
Yeah. But I just am curious, like, what you make of all this.
I don't actually, I'm not depressed about it. I really think, no matter what the stats are, the industry as a whole, and like, for example, the vinyl resurgence or whatever, yes, it's true. Vinyl numbers have been doubling year after year for the last few years. But if you look at the records, vinyl record sales from 2015 and compare them to vinyl record sales in 1975, it's a tiny, tiny fraction.
Yeah.
And the idea that it will ever get to the same level that it was in the mid-70s, for example, is preposterous. It's not going to.
But why has it's probably harder for us to have this perspective. The same thing is happening with film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the same, the movies are getting, I mean, I think, I was just, my friend who has kids was saying he went to see, what's the new movie with, Bill Murray's in a new movie. I can't remember what it is. It's like a kid's movie, I think.
I don't know.
The Jungle Book.
Oh, The Jungle Book.
They remade the Jungle Book again. I don't know how many versions there are, but he went to see it and I texted back. I don't even go to movies anymore. They all suck. I don't like it. I just don't go anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that mentality, and you know, people are, home theater systems are more affordable. Everyone's got a giant.
Well, and no one ever feels guilt about, I mean, I think movies are even more extreme because no one ever feels guilt about stealing a movie for free off the internet. They may feel guilt about doing it for a band. They may then go to the show and buy a t-shirt out of guilt. But they don't, you know, then they don't go up to the director of that movie and buy his t-shirt. Doesn't happen.
A lot of the kind of righteous indignation about the music industry manifested itself in downloading, in finding things on your own.
Yeah.
Without, and I think the same thing is happening with movies, where people are just like, they've been shoveling this crap to us for so long, and it's all like reboots and not great stories really anymore. Forget it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but I think in terms of the music, I mean, this is just my opinion, Ariel. Feel free to disagree with me, and I'm sure you will. But I don't think it's depressing in terms of the music, because no matter how much major labels will endlessly reissue their back catalogs, no matter how much people will, you know, mostly stop paying for recorded music, there are still fans. Kind of like what you were saying before, you know, it's kind of condensing fandom into this really crystalline sort of dense purity or whatever, where the people that are coming to the shows and the people that are buying records are super fans, you know? And so I feel like we don't have casual fans anymore. Not that we ever did, but like, you know, we don't have like, we've never had like masses of people who are just like listening casually to a song or two. Like the people that like us really, really like us. Yeah. And I like that, you know, I would prefer to have 100 people that really love what we're doing than, you know, 1,000 people or 10,000 people or whatever who are kind of ambivalent or fair weather fans or whatever.
You guys both play, or your band rather, played Glastonbury a year or two ago.
Yeah.
Ariel, what was that experience like? So that's a general audience. I assume you, sorry if this is presumptuous, I assume you played like a side stage. You weren't on the gigantic stage. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's okay. Correct.
So you're not facing hundreds of thousands of people or whatever it is.
No, I think there are about 500 to 1,000 people
at our
show. That's
pretty amazing still. Yeah. What was that experience like? Because that's an audience that, were you aware of people who knew you really well?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were definitely obviously some fans in that crowd because, they were wearing t-shirts.
You had that Lionel Richie t-shirt for sale?
Exactly, yeah.
Which I get. I have one of those and people, it says The Burning Hell, but it's a cartoon rendering of Lionel Richie.
That's right, yes.
Why is that again?
Well, there's a reference to Lionel Richie in one of the songs from People, our last album. So, yeah. Okay. People like it on the t-shirt, you know?
I get asked about it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
People aren't sure who it is.
Right. Right. Okay, yeah.
I can't remember who they think it is, but I just know I've had, they're like, is that? I'm like, Lionel Richie. They're like, no. I don't know where they were going to go.
And interesting.
It can be awkward.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because they might, is that Barbra Streisand? Like, I don't know who they think it is. Anyway, what was the experience like of playing to a general audience for the first time in a while?
I think it was really good, actually. Glastonbury was probably a really positive experience in terms of playing to a general audience. It's always a little, now that I think about it a little more clearly, it was weird. It was weird, maybe. Go ahead.
I just want to say it was awesome. I want to say Glastonbury was awesome.
Yeah.
I have fond memories of it. It was intense and crazy. I mean, I think it's the biggest outdoor music festival in the world, right? In terms of numbers.
Maybe a big day out in Australia.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
That was crazy. And there were elements of it that were upsetting, just in terms of like the way they have to run it because it's so big. Like the security was a little upsetting. But I have to say, for a festival that size, with that much security and that much whatever, it was a remarkably fun experience.
Yes, and I would say that we actually did two sets at Glastonbury, and the first one was this bigger set, and there were obviously like a lot of people who were really into it and some people who looked kind of bored. It was 11 o'clock in the morning on a Friday.
Oh, man.
You know, and so it was difficult, but then we played a later show at this little tent bar thing, and there were maybe 20 people to 50 people at that, and that was really fantastic, and everybody, like, people lost their brains, and it was the most fun. So I think the answer to all of this is that general audiences shows are difficult.
And sorry,
the fan shows are better.
To segue into another part of this like whole what's happening to the music these days, these kids, blah, blah, blah kind of conversation, is let's talk about festivals, because I feel like the one thing that's really happening in the music industry now is there's a new festival, literally like in the last 2 seconds that we were just talking, there's 60 new festivals in Ontario, in Toronto,
probably,
that just happened right now.
Do you think like we're reaching peak festival?
No, we're well past peak festival.
Yeah.
And it's going to burst.
But like, do you think it's like, I was wondering if it has burst already.
Like I think it'll take two more summers.
Okay. Yeah.
Before, I am affiliated with a few different festivals.
Yeah.
And I work relatively closely with the Hillside Festival, mm-hmm. who have seen their landscape shift.
Of course, yeah.
Because another festival opened up right in the backyard of Guelph, basically modeling itself after the Hillside Festival. You guys played it, the one in Elora. The Riverfest.
Oh, right.
And just down the road, about a month apart, a lot of the same kinds of artists, price points are about the same, experientially they're trying to do the same thing. Hillside wasn't the first festival, obviously, but they've had to cope with, over the years, people from Ottawa and Toronto, and I guess now Elora, have said, hey, how do you do this to them? And they've said, oh, well, that's nice of you to ask, and thanks for noticing, and here's how you do it. You know, you have a great kids area, so it's a family-friendly event.
Right.
We don't do any corporate sponsorship. Mm-hmm. We try to make an eclectic lineup. And then they all said, oh, cool. And they all kind of made their own festivals. I'm not necessarily begrudging anyone for this. What I am upset by is that all kind of loyalty... where the loyalty factor comes into play is that some of these folks are sort of inexperienced budget-wise. And if someone says, hey, if you want Metric to play in your town, it's going to cost you $200,000. That's what an agent will say. Mm-hmm. And some of the newer, older festivals would be like, what are you, crazy? I'm not paying you that. Like, I'm just picking Metric and whatever. I'm making up a price point. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
These are all hypotheticals. But a seasoned festival artistic director would say, okay, that's an interesting first volley. Here's my counteroffer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably going to be half that because my budget is only about 200K. I'm not going to be able to give one band all of our budget.
Of course.
The newer festival people are like, okay, mm-hmm. sure, we'll give you 200K. And then that alters the landscape,
right?
Because no one can compete when some of these folks have capital investors who are just like, we're going to give you enough money to make this festival happen for 5 years.
Absolutely.
And see how it goes.
Well, and I think that's a really good point. And I think also what I have seen more and more recently is a lot of festivals that are offering those guarantees and then not being able to pay the bands. I feel like that seems to be happening a lot. And I know that
you're here right now because you're not...
All Tomorrow's Parties.
I'm wearing my Drive Like Jehu t-shirt all weekend. I've worn it. It smells at this point because I've been wearing it for 2 days. But yeah, I was supposed to be at in England. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we weren't going to be able to talk, so it all worked out well that we're here. I'm glad I'm not there, frankly, because it's not happening.
Yes.
Yeah, it'd be
but
weird
if you're there. Like a festival made this just like the most incredible artistic. They give, ATP gives their, they ask someone to curate, a band to curate, an artist to curate, and then they put together this amazing thing. And then they, it just didn't happen. Because
and this is not the first time something like that
has
happened.
ATP, this is a potentially, this is an infrastructure institutional issue with this particular company. But it's going to happen more.
Yeah.
Because everyone's dependent on, most people are dependent on ticket sales, but some people aren't. Some people have, you know, as I say, kind of silent partners. Mm-hmm. They may not look corporate, but they've got an infusion of cash.
Yeah, they've got some secret money. Like, oh, it's your first festival in Ontario. Like, why not hire you Neil Young to headline your festival? You know?
And let's give Neil Young, I don't know if this is talking out of turn, but Neil Young made $2 million for playing last year at that festival in Oro Medante. Is that how you say it? I'm not sure how you say it. But the thing in the Way Home Festival.
Yeah.
And my understanding
first year of the festival.
First year of the festival, and they, you know, obviously they're going to look at the landscape and then and try to dominate. I mean, this year's lineup for that festival is bananas if you are like an indie rock or whatever person. If you're like, you know. I don't know what to tell you about it. We are in a phase of, which I think is healthy. I mean, I think you and I and us three probably came of age with fairly open-minded musical tastes, and you guys talk about amateur rappers in your music, and you are ostensibly a folk rock band, you know, so maybe 10, 20 years ago, it would be kind of weird for you to go into that direction, right? Because there was more of an orthodoxy about genre.
Yeah.
But with the internet and information being so free now, people are like, oh, I can listen to whatever I want, and I can be proud of that.
Yeah.
Everyone's kind of a generalist, and so these festivals that Remember, I don't even know if you remember this. You lived in Peterborough, and you are, there are political machinations around your Peterborough Folk Festival, right? Like, everyone has a old school, it's a folk festival. It's not a rock festival. We don't have hip hop at our folk festival.
Yeah.
All of that is melted away, which is good.
Yeah.
But it just means that all these festivals can cater to everyone.
Yeah.
And people will go because our tastes are so varied now, but it also sort of seems watered down. No one has an aesthetic.
Yeah.
The other side of it too, the other side of that is that I think that on the audience's part, what people want more and more is a musical experience.
Yes.
They don't necessarily want to watch a show. They want to go to a festival and have a festival weekend and be able to Instagram it.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Talk about it and talk about it in experiential terms and not talk about it necessarily in musical terms.
And leave with a t-shirt.
And leave with a t-shirt.
Like the t-shirt, that thing that we talked about is really emblematic of people's attitudes towards music now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They'll pay money to go to a club and they'll talk while the headlining band is playing.
Yeah.
And you see it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I've always been aware of that. Like I'm a super fan. Like if I go to something, I'm going because I care. It's not my right probably to police people's passion levels, but it's fashion. Like a lot of what we're seeing now is just fashion and there's all this money going into it because it's hip to do. But I mean,
the reason that I'm not depressed though, I realize that I never finished saying why I'm not depressed is because ultimately music is, something that people will continue to do themselves, for a long time.
Yep.
No matter what, regardless of whether people are buying records or t-shirts or not buying either of those things or wanting to go to festivals versus club shows, musicians and songwriters will keep doing their thing regardless of whether or not anybody's listening. And that's exciting to me.
That is exciting. I'm, you know, in this show, and I've talked about this a lot, obviously, that's kind of what I do too.
Yeah.
There's not huge, I'm not making money. The audience kind of comes and goes on some level. It's doing fine, but it's not, I wish it was. I'm happy with what we do on the show and I'm happy you're on the show, but it's at the same time, sometimes when you are confronted with metrics, you're like, or record sales or whatever these days, you're like, why? Like, is there, what's the point of
it's
this?
It's totally upsetting to sort of look at, you know, how hard it is to make a living, you know, doing this compared to even 5 years ago. Like it's changed drastically.
Yeah.
And that's sad and that sucks or whatever, but you know, music as a commodity has changed radically over the last 100 years, and it's gone through all sorts of different phases, and we can't expect it to stay the same. It didn't stay the same between the 20s and the 50s, and it didn't stay the same between the 50s and the 80s, and you know, things are changing. People are making money in different ways now, and ultimately people will always continue to do music and find a way to do music one way or another. And so I'm not worrying, I guess I'm not worrying about the ability of new sounds to, you know, enter the world.
Yeah, no, you I know, think that the,
that's safe.
On some level, you know, you are reveling in, we were talking about the relative lack of oversight in your creative endeavors, which is a great aspect of the time.
Yeah.
But it does, it makes me wonder how sustainable it is for all of you and all of us to keep doing it in the face of, certainly in your case it's not indifference. You have an audience, like you've cultivated an audience and they're coming out and they're picking up records and all that stuff, but maybe it's kind of good. Maybe it's like a weird survival of the fittest thing. Maybe it's, although maybe that's just capitalism. Maybe we're just, I'm now being like, oh, capitalism was right.
Capitalism is right. The market wins.
The market was right and the demands, I feel like that's what's happening. Like it seems free. It seems like there's this deregulation and everyone can do what they want, but everything is so based on numerical data.
And the music industry is still calling the shots.
Yeah.
I mean, Let's not fool ourselves.
And they've figured out ways to get people to buy more product just by reselling them the same stuff they used to own.
Yeah.
And these all these formats we were talking about. We were talking about motivation, so it seems like a good time to ask both of you what got you into music and what keeps you playing in this band. Ariel, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, I took a kind of funny path because I, you know, I think I was one of those kids that probably could have benefited from a girls' rock camp back in the day, like a shy, introverted, like nerdy girl. And I played the clarinet in high school, and then kind of like gave that up. And it was just after I finished university, I was living in Toronto, and I was pretty sad, and I bought a clarinet on eBay, and that's when I took it up again, and Matthias and I started playing with Matthias just a little bit, and then that kind of blossomed into more and more, and in a way, yeah, has given me this like really interesting opportunity to, I think, like play the clarinet in a way that most people don't, and do some different, yeah, to approach it a bit differently. So, and my motivation for keeping going is because I guess that playing shows is probably the happiest that I've ever been.
You seem incredibly happy. You seem like you're having the time of your life when you're on stage.
Yeah, well, I love it more than anything.
Oh, nice.
So, so as long as I can do it, I will continue doing it. And I'm very glad that I managed to like take this kind of circuitous route into music because I wanted nothing more than to be in a like a punk band when I was a teenager, but I didn't see, you know, I didn't see that opportunity for myself at that time.
Yeah.
And so to have been able to kind of like play this like nerdy junior high school band instrument all over the world, you know, has been like a pretty like weird and gratifying way of like reclaiming that, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's my path.
And Matthias, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved music since I was, you know, a little kid, and it wasn't though until I was in my late 20s that I started really taking it seriously at all. And I mean, even seriously, I'm not sure what I mean by that, but started thinking about performing my songs for other people, I guess. It wasn't until I was in my late 20s.
This is when you were in Peterborough?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Peterborough is a very, I mean, I'm not sure what it's like now, but at the time, you know, it was a very welcoming artistic community. It was a great place to sort of get started and feel like, even if you weren't doing the best thing of all time on stage, there was like a community of people that were very supportive of that. And that was a great place to play music back then. And I guess, yeah, I mean, once I got my foot in the door or my first sort of taste of performing, same as Ariel said, I mean, it's the most gratifying experience I've ever had being on stage.
You guys have this song that we referenced earlier, Fuck the Government, I Love You. And it's, you know, you guys, Matthias, I know you to be in particular, you in particular to be a very observational songwriter. Is this song chronicles a meeting? Is it, in fact, the way you two met? Like, it seems to outline a very specific circumstance in which you met. Is it true?
Yeah, I think it's mostly true. I think that party is in the song is a bit of an amalgamation of several Trent University parties.
Oh, sure, sure.
But yeah, I would say that the essence of it is 100% true.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You just sort of met and that's where, and you just, in the song, you say, you mentioned that you play clarinet or something and you say, well, you're in the band.
Yeah. And that's kind of how it happened. That is exactly how it happened.
Right.
I mean, we maybe the timeline is messed with a little bit in that song.
Sure. No. I'm not suggesting, but this is not an inquisition.
But yeah, I mean, that's like, I was really excited when Ariel told me that she had bought a clarinet and was sort of taking it up again, and we just started playing together like a couple times, just like casually.
I was smitten, and then you saw this opportunity to actually collaborate. Yeah,
absolutely, and it's the best.
Now, your band, The Burning Hell, has always had, I think, a fairly overt political standpoint. You've written songs about various points in history that have been significant, and you can find the surreal absurdity of some of these situations. Ariel just said something to me about, or said something rather, about a girls' rock camp. And that's significant to me because we are, I think, as much as we're talking about this age and what's going on, we're living in a time where I'm feeling better about how empowered people are feeling. These girls' rock camps are popping up more and more. There's more and more outspokenness about how horribly white and male, sorry, Matthias, and chauvinistic the music industry has been. And I feel that changing, like just because people are talking about it more. Ariel, like, have you led a girls' rock camp?
No.
Because there was one in Peterborough, right?
There was one in Peterborough. There continues to be one in Peterborough. Yeah. I guess I've never been anywhere long enough. And St. John's is just starting one this summer.
St. John's, Newfoundland. Yeah, right.
And now we don't live there anymore. So, I've never had an opportunity. But, I mean, I would love to do something like that. I'm a big fan of the...
Maybe it's not insignificant that everywhere you leave, someone's like, I want to do that. I'm going to start a girls' rock camp. That's got to be... There's something going on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be me.
Do you have any perspective on, because I know, I mean, you had a horrible experience that you talked about on Facebook about a sound tech treating you poorly at a festival recently.
Right.
And I don't really like to be heavy-handed with these, like, tell me about being a woman in music things, but in the context of what we were just discussing, Girls Rock Camp, potentially a kind of enlightenment going on about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
What is your perspective on that as someone who plays music around the world? I mean,
yeah.
Do you feel like you're treated differently or better, or what's going on?
Wow. I think usually we are very lucky to operate within a kind of DIY network that is political by its very nature. And so I think a lot of the people that we deal with are really... are pretty progressive and great to deal with. And I really haven't had that many issues.
Okay.
Luckily, I mean, I think just more a general sense of when I was younger, feeling really shut out of what the like small music community was at my high school and stuff like that. But since as part of the Burning Hell, I mean, I haven't had many issues except for that one time. And occasionally, you know, I have troubles explaining to people that I understand the basics of certain technologies.
Yeah. People underestimate you still.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly. And it's also weird, you know. I mean, I'm a side musician. I play like a pretty feminine instrument. I mean, I think there's a reason why a lot of people want to, you know, who wanted.
I don't think people could see the air quotes around feminine just there.
Oh, okay. Well, they were there.
They could feel them.
But I guess, you know, there's a reason why. You know, I had a very short-lived punk band, and I get why people want to do music like that in a feminist spirit, because, you know, it feels very important, and that feels to have been a particularly chauvinist area of music, and certainly that is part of the reason why in high school I had a difficult time with that kind of crowd, I guess. But yeah, being a woman playing a clarinet in a rock band is like a kind of completely different thing. So I have to kind of think about my gender in terms of that. In like it's all other guys in the band, you know.
Yeah,
it's not in a different way, I guess. And I find that an interesting thing to think about. I don't have any explicit answers about it, but I do hope to kind of consider how being a side musician and playing like an unconventional rock instrument and also being like the partner of the main songwriter who is a man.
Yeah.
Like, how do I get to feel good about my own agency and power within that situation? And of course the band is great. And it's not a macho band or anything, but it is something that I think about a lot anyway.
Can I just add something to that?
Yeah.
I think that what you said at the beginning was so interesting, because the assumption that because we sort of work in a more or less DIY network or whatever, like an indie rock network or whatever,
what you discover, I think, and I think where you're going with this is that we tend to live in a vacuum of, we think we're in a progressive realm, but surprisingly,
until we find out that we're not.
Yeah.
And those,
yeah.
And that's why when that happens, it's so much more shocking, I guess,
yeah.
and upsetting. But
yeah, and I mean,
yeah,
it's
and
sort
I don't mean to. Sorry, I don't mean to say that, you know, DIY networks are therefore infallible or anything.
No, I didn't think you were saying that. I just think it's a good point because it directly gets at our assumptions as a band, you know, and all of our friends and everything. We're all cool, right? So everyone else must be cool too. And then when it does happen, when you do get that, you know, that one sound technician or whatever that sort of says something that probably is par for the course in a lot of the music industry, but we don't experience it that often. It's devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it seems like someone has entered our realm.
Yeah.
And is an interloper, really.
Interloper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So people who don't know The Burning Hell should know that the band has evolved a lot in terms of its membership, in part because you've lived in Berlin, you've lived in Peterborough, you've lived in St. John's, Newfoundland. So out of necessity, you've kept the band going with different people. It seems to me that when the band started, musical proficiency wasn't necessarily the main consideration for membership in the band. I don't know if this is true necessarily. It just seemed like Matthias, and you can, I want to say this without making you uncomfortable.
No, you're not making me uncomfortable.
Well, I don't want to suggest that you saw it as a means to make people feel empowered or better about themselves or anything, but there was a community mindedness about it in its early days, particularly when you were ensconced in a community. You guys are now in PEI.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have any people from PEI in your band at the moment.
Just Ariel.
Right. I mean, and yeah, you two are kind of, anyway, one of you is, you're heading back to PEI? You're in Toronto for school, Ariel, and
yes.
You'll head back.
Yeah.
So in any case, my sense is that the current configuration of the band is still the Newfoundland. Is Nick still in the band?
Oh, yeah.
So you got a bit of Peterborough, a little Newfoundland. So the band has kept together. But where I was going was, it seemed to be a community-minded thing and a reflection of your community. Why, if that's accurate, and if that was of paramount importance to you in keeping the band going, why was that a thing that you were hopeful to do?
I wish that I could say that that was, you know, completely intentional. That was the main strategy, that I was sort of, you know, orchestrating an empowering community-minded band. I would love to claim that. But the reality is that I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. And in the early years of the band, I didn't actually think that it was real. You know, I just thought, oh, well, this is cool. We'll go on a tour. What's a tour? Let's find out, you know, who wants to come? And that's sort of how it evolved, very organically that way. And Peterborough is that kind of music scene anyway, where everyone's playing in each other's bands, or at least it was at the time.
Your band started when a rather large band called the Silver Hearts was a going concern.
Yeah, and every band in Peterborough was like that, a revolving door membership.
14, 15 people
yeah. or whatever. And that can only work in a town that's that sort of small, or a music scene that's that sort of small and cooperative and whatever, and collaborative. And that was super inspiring. And so that's how it started. And then after about a year or two of actually touring all the time, I started realizing this is totally untenable.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, like, the current lineup, the five of us, you know, Ariel and myself and Darren and Jake and Nick, that's been the lineup since 2011. It hasn't changed at all in 5 years. So it was early days, the first couple years of the band, where it was sort of all over the map, hodgepodge, and every tour would be a different number of people or whatever. But it's been really consistent since around 2011, the five of us. And you know, in some ways, I you know, I have super fond memories of that time and that sort of chaotic energy, I guess, that was going on back then. But at a certain point, I just realized, like, I need to have a band of people that are somewhat stable and committed to doing this thing.
It probably made the stakes seem lower when you had that many people in the band. Like,
yeah.
On some level, you were like, well, who knows what's going to happen every night. I remember when we first started practicing for our three-piece configuration for the tour I was alluding to earlier, I was a bit nervous because I had to learn Burning Hell songs and Wax Mannequin songs, but you really set me at ease because you seemed to care a lot but not care that much.
Which yeah.
It's a difficult balancing act of, like, I want this to go well, but it's going to work out fine.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the other thing, too, is that it forced me, this is an unexpected benefit of of the chaos of the early years of the Burning Hell is that it really forced me to lean on the songs themselves.
Yeah.
And trust that, or hope anyway, that no matter who was on stage, no matter what the instrumentation was, that something in the song would come across to people.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was successful or not, but I think that a lot of the reputation of the band stems from that time, you know. And it's funny to me now, and I think it's funny to Ariel and the others as well, because it hasn't been that way for so long. But in a lot of circles, we're still seen as this like ramshackle collective of bohemians who just, you know, it's just like absolutely couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, it's stabilized. It's a real
It's a band,
firm band. Yeah. Well, it's for what it's worth, and you know, I have my biases, obviously, because I love you two. Bono is awesome. No, I love you guys. It's a remarkable catalog of songs. You know, you remain one of my favorite songwriters anywhere. So, it's amazing that you made time to be on the show with us. With me, I can't talk. I'm getting overwhelmed with emotion. You've got two records out, essentially. Like, that's what you've given me. What can you tell us about this thing, first of all?
Well,
this is Ariel Sharratt and Matthias Kamm, Don't Believe the Hyperreal. What?
So Ariel and I, we started performing as a duo a couple of years ago in Berlin when we were living there. And for a while, we were sort of just doing Burning Hell songs as a duo, and then we started thinking about changing that up a bit, and that's our first record as a duo.
Nice.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of songs that show up.
There's one song. The Government I Love You is on both, because we couldn't decide. It's two different versions. We couldn't decide which one we like better, so we just kept on both albums. So then there's the other album, which is the new full band Burning Hell album called Public Library, which I have a question for you about.
Okay. Yes, go
for
it.
Is that all right?
Yes, of course.
So
turn the tables.
So I asked you to write a blurb or an essay, really, for a miniature essay for the back of this record, and you did, and I loved it. And I wonder if you could just read the first three paragraphs.
What?
Yeah, can you do that?
Why?
Because Ariel has some questions for you.
I do.
Yeah.
The first three paragraphs.
They're short paragraphs. Okay.
We get weird when things change. It makes us paranoid and disappointed that we placed our trust in something, as though the core or essence of it has been compromised somehow. Things can get so bad in our fixations with quote-unquote progress, we might blind ourselves to the more enticing aspects of spiritual and physical evolution. It's as futile as screaming at a clock. I mention all of this because the Burning Hell has changed a lot over the past decade, but are also essentially still the same. An idiosyncratic hub that trusts ideas and invention first and worries about bypassing logistical parameters maybe fourth or fifth. Because they are funny and present rather empathetic, selfless perspectives via catchy-ass songs, they are not lauded as the truly great band they are by self-serious arbiters of taste in the media who will throw in with fashion before consistency 8 days a week. At one point, their founder, primary lyricist and singer Matthias Kamm, played punk songs with a ukulele, which is a very tiny guitar that macho men do not take seriously. Now he plays an electric guitar, and macho men are still kind of dicks about it. Those are the first three paragraphs.
Yeah.
Why did I have to do that?
I just wanted to hear you read it. That was one thing. But no, Ariel was asking me about it yesterday, and she was like, does Vish think that we're not cool?
You're asking me if I don't think you're cool.
No. Well, no. Yes. Yeah. I think it's an interesting question. I don't mean it as a just like, Vish, don't you think
that's
cool?
That's an interesting question, because I am advocating for your coolness.
Yeah.
But in a way that questions why more people don't get into it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
That's what I was doing there, I think.
But the premise is that we are not cool.
No, the premise is that you're not considered cool by people who normally are like, oh my God, the new, I don't know.
Right.
I don't want to throw anyone under the bus.
So we are cool to you.
My point is that you're super cool, but people don't always recognize it because you're funny. And I do think that when you're irreverent, it's harder to come across as serious. People like to say like that serious thing is really cool.
Right.
And then if you can build that up enough, then people attend. I don't want to, you're not in any similar realm, but look at Wilco.
Yeah.
Wilco is a band that I would say was ostensibly quite serious. There were some little things where the sense of humor came through, but they had to make a series of very serious records before they got into things like We're Gonna Call Our Album Wilco the Album, and their latest album has all sorts of funny, funny songs on it that are, for whatever reason, I still think humor is viewed as a novelty. Wit is viewed as a novelty. Meanwhile, I mean, my favorite songwriters are people who are so funny. David Berman of the Silver Jews.
Absolutely.
You know, you may not always catch it, but Will Oldham. Like, there's people who are able to infuse their music that is kind of serious with humor. Mean the world to me. And Carolyn Mark. I mean, there's so many examples of Jeff Berner.
Totally.
There's so many great examples of people that I don't think get the credit they deserve because people don't assume they're serious enough. And that's where I'm going with that.
Yeah, that's actually something that we were talking about a lot this morning, I guess, based on that, is what place humor has in music. And I think you're absolutely right that a lot of, I mean, almost all of my favorite songwriters are funny in some way, you know.
The Beatles were really funny.
Absolutely. But, yeah,
I feel like you've been put on the spot after...
Sorry, let me...
Mathias is like, I'm going to put both of these people on the spot.
Yeah, exactly.
You read a thing you wrote. You comment on it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I do feel like that's how it went down. I didn't mean for you guys to feel like you're on the spot.
I felt fine about it. I fumbled a bit.
I really love what you wrote. And there's more, you know, for your listeners. You should know there's a lot more.
There's three more paragraphs. Why were those first three? Why did they?
No, just because I think that, like, the essence of what you're saying there comes across already in the first three paragraphs.
Right.
But I think it's interesting to think about the fact that we're not cool. I don't think we're cool.
Yeah.
And I'm totally fine with that. And that's what kind of why I love what you wrote so much is, you know, you see that on the back of a record or in a press kit or whatever. You don't see someone say, like, you know what? Nobody thinks these guys are cool. But here's why, you know, they are good.
Yeah,
you know?
That's where I was going.
And I think that's a much more interesting way to talk about a band than to just say, you know, oh, this life-changing sonic experience, blah, 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 blah. You know, to write something serious about people who are already trying to be so serious about their music.
And it's not a self-pitying or a pitying thing. I mean, you've got lots of coverage from media sources around the world. And the people who, like you said earlier, the people who love you, love you. It's not... Just from my perspective, I see the things that get more attention than others, and I've been talking about this a little bit on the show because of various conversations about the relationship between a fan and obscurity, or rather a fan and an artist and obscurity. And I don't think you're obscure necessarily, but on some level you are.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. So, yeah. So my premise was basically that when you love something that is a public thing and the general public aren't aware of it, as a fan, sometimes you go out of if you have the platform, you will go out of your way to try to convert people to the thing you love. And you start to sound like a psychopath.
Yeah.
Because all you'll talk about is the Burning Hell or Al Tuck or whoever you think is like worthy of more attention than they get. But I think it's also because, you know, people have made a lot about the fact that we're losing lots of iconic artists in the year 2016.
Yeah.
And I'm a parent, and before I know it, spring is here and summer is here, and I don't even know where the winter went and the fall went. I know they're happening.
Yeah, Axl Rose is fronting AC/DC, and you don't know what's going on.
Life is fleeting and strange, and I'm trying to... And when you get to our age, you recognize that... When you get to middle age, you recognize that everything is more precious than you thought it was, or were aware that it was before. So that's why you, if you have the energy and effort to put into something like I did for you guys, you do it.
Yeah.
You start to champion things and start to be like, you know, let's get to the heart of what makes my life worthwhile.
Yeah.
On some level, it's the songs of the Burning Hell. You know what I mean? Like
totally, absolutely. And I think that. I think people enjoy being fans on such a sort of intense level. I do, you know, and just like you said, you know, like I won't rest until everybody that I know also loves Wax Mannequin and also loves Al Tuck and also loves Construction and Destruction. On and on and on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah, It doesn't feel futile. It feels like a part of the deal we make as fans. It's a weird interaction. You're having, in some cases, like we're in a realm where we interact with the people we admire in some ways. Certainly I am. You know, I end up talking to people that mean a great deal to me. And that's weird. Yeah. But I also think that without that interaction, we have a conversation as a listener and a creator.
Yeah.
Or an artist. You're communicating. It's a communication thing. It can seem one-sided, but then if you make something great and someone receives it and they tell someone else about it, you're now part of two conversations with a record you made.
Yeah.
That's not something you can underestimate or undervalue. That's something very vital, and it's what keeps us all talking.
Absolutely.
So anyway, I don't mean to soapbox it here, but I'm high on all this cappuccino and this banana. I was going to say, and I cut myself off, the offshoot of the coffee drinking, I have a horrible sweet tooth. You might remember this.
I do, yeah.
I always wanted a cake or candy or something. I got a terrible sweet tooth. So I'm eating more sweets with the coffee to balance the bitterness. So I actually like having a waffle with my coffee or a muffin with my coffee. I don't need them.
No.
So it's making me, I'm caffeinated and addicted to caffeine, and now I'm getting fat. So thanks a lot, coffee. Thanks a lot. What's coming up next for you guys in terms of Burning Hell activity?
We are about to go on tour. We'll be touring all through May and June in Europe and the UK and Canada. And that's the foreseeable future. I mean,
that's fine. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And Ariel, where can people who are listening to this via the internet? Most of these podcasts live on the internet. It's weird. Where should people go to follow you guys the way people follow people these days? I mean,
well, we're on all of the following platforms.
ICQ, MySpace.
Yeah, Friendster.
Yeah.
So our website is wearetheburninghell.com. And that you can find us all the other following things through that. I guess.
At the Burning Hell on Twitter and
Facebook/TheBurningHell at the Burning Hell Band or whatever on Instagram.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
we got them all.
Good. I hope people follow you wherever you go to your car, wherever it is.
Just buy a T-shirt, people. Just buy
What is there a song from Public Library that we can go out on right now for people to hear?
Sure. Well, since you've talked so much about it,
we could
play "Fuck the Government, I Love You."
Okay. I guess we talked about it. It's basically a slight origin story of your relationship.
Yeah, it's not slight. I mean,
it's basically the origin.
Substantial.
Story. Yes.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And it's funny, I think,
but not too funny.
Now, I want to say this, and I hope he doesn't mind that I say this out of turn, but I have developed a slight pen pal relationship with David Berman of Silver Jews.
Blowing my mind.
Blowing my mind. Anyway, we sometimes will exchange songs we like. So he sent me something, and then I just recently sent him your song, this song that we're about to hear. And he really loved it. And he commented on the structure of it. Like, he actually listened to it, and he was like, it was interesting of them not to go for the chorus as many times as they could have, because it's such a funny chorus. I imagine that would be irresistible. I admire their restraint.
I think I can actually just stop playing music now, because I can't imagine achieving anything better in the world of music than knowing that David Berman heard a song that I wrote.
Well, that's nice.
I'm serious. This is it.
Come on.
What am I supposed to do now?
So last Burning Hell album, we've already established that. You're not going to make any more records.
No.
And now you're just done.
Well, maybe, I don't know, we could keep making T-shirts.
Yeah. Well, in any case, it's a brilliant song, and at least myself and David Berman think so. So thank you for being on this show, Matthias and Ariel, and obviously best of luck with everything. And I love you both.
I love you too, Vish. Yeah.
Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Vish.
Thanks. Met at the New Year's party of my vegetarian friend.
I said I was studying English.
I told you I was in a band.
I asked what the band was called.
I said it's called The Burning Hell.
I said I've never heard of you.
I said that's probably just as well. just to make conversation. I told you about a dream I had with Jean Baudrillard, was rapping with Public Enemy, shouting, "Don't believe the hyper real," with Flava Flav and Chuck D.
And I said, I think we might have a lot in common then, possibly because I'm also a musician and also a student of hip-hoposophy.
You mentioned you used to play the clarinet in high school in the early years of the millennium when you were young.
And you said you're hired, the pay is negligible, and the tour starts next month.
You asked what I was working on. I said, I'm writing an album of love songs.
I laughed and said, love songs are dumb.
And I said, yeah, wait till you hear these ones.
Pass the wine, fuck the government, I love you. Three statements overheard at once in the crowded room. But I could not be sure which one had come from you.
So I passed you the wine and said, yes, fuck the government, I love you too.
Dancers, we danced a little bit.
My vegetarian friend was playing the hits of Will Smith, and we got jiggy with it there on the dance floor.
The living room dance floor,
that's where it happened. You stole my heart.
I stole a kiss.
We stole someone else's gin by accident.
At some point, we got cornered by an amateur poet neither of us knew.
Either he had no one else to talk to or couldn't pick up on simple social cues.
Step by step, we backed away until we backed up all the way into the bathroom together.
We told the poet that we always go together, 'cause that's what happens when you've been dating forever. We stayed in there for ages, hoping the amateur poet would go. It was awkward. We came out and found he discovered someone else to bother. And suddenly it was midnight, and old anxiety time, countdowns and gratuitous public making out. And we started shouting, 'cause everyone else was shouting. And isn't it fun to shout? The wine, fuck the government, I love you. Three statements overheard at once in the crowded room. But I could not be sure which one had come from you. So I passed you the wine and said, yes, fuck the government, I love you too. Yes, fuck the government, I love you too.
There you have it, brand new music by The Burning Hell. That was Fuck the Government, I Love You, from the new album Public Library. Thanks to Matthias and Ariel for being on the program. Always fun to talk to those two. Just a reminder, we were talking there about Lawn Yavanya in St. John's, Newfoundland. I will be doing a live taping at the Lawn Yavanya Festival on May 6th at the Rocket Room. And I hope you'll come out. I think it's at 8 p.m. It'll be fun. If you're going to Lawn Yavanya or you want to go to Newfoundland, hey, you should come see the show. Also, Lawn Yavanya is great. You should learn more about it at lawnyavanya.com. It's spelled just how it sounds. It's going to be fun. I'm excited. And I'll be hosting. I'll be hosting all throughout the festival as well. So you can just come say hello. If you hear this and you remember, come say hi. I like to say hi to people. It'll be fun. If you want to listen or subscribe or download or do whatever you want with this podcast, well, within reason. Don't be weird. Go to iTunes, audioboom.com, vishkana.com. Those are places where the show exists in some form or another. You can also make a flexible monthly donation to the program at patreon.com. Creative Control of VishCon is on Facebook. We're on Twitter at Vish Creative. And you can listen to a version of the show every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time at CFRU.ca or in the local area at 93.3 FM. And I believe the show slot will be going now from noon to 2 p.m. as opposed from noon to 1. So I might actually, if I can find the time, I might take an hour and just spin some records, as they used to say back in the day. So who knows? You might actually hear some actual music beyond the music people on the show. You might hear some good stuff. I will be in St. John's, Newfoundland, but I plan to deploy, or at least prepare episodes for deployment before I leave. I had a really, really great chat with Bob Mayer, who's the author of this new book about the Replacements. It's called Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. I'm hoping to put that out next week. And I don't know what the other thing will be, but it's going to be great. It is great. I just had a good time talking to him. I can't wait to share that with you. And he was a very nice guy. So that is one of the plans. And there'll be other plans too. So hopefully you will come back and listen to that episode. All right, I got to go. We'll talk soon. Goodbye for now.